This is the Senate Committee on Labor, Consumer, and Business Affairs meeting in hearing room B at 8 o'clock a.m. on Friday, April 15th, 1977.
10:49. And our first witness is Carl Frederick, AOI.
Good morning, Carl Frederick with Associated Avenue Industries. And Roy Green was going to join me in testimony, but he's lost someplace, so I'll begin without him.
Here he is now.
Here he is. I don't know if it's symbolic, Mr. Chairman, but today is the anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic.
Is that right?
So I don't know what that means.
Please.
Well, we should be so lucky. We should be so lucky. I would like to speak briefly in support of the portion of Senate Bill 1040. I particularly refer to
1049.
Excuse me. It's not Form 1040.
Thank you.
Senate Bill
1040. 1049, page 4, subparagraph 3, particularly, the validity of using the American Medical Association guides for the evaluation of permanent impairment.
Thank you.
The AMA guides cover all of the body systems of whole man and sets forth an appraisal of the nature and extent of an injury as it affects the individual's personal efficiency in one or more of the activities of daily living, self-care, communication, normal living postures, ambulation, elevation, travel, and non-specialized hand activities. Now, the preface to the guides states, and I quote, all of the guides have been developed after a careful study of the literature and views of recognized authorities. Each guide contains recommended percentage values related to the criteria provided, and the use of numerical values is preferred because of difficulty in communication and the variability in interpretation of such terms as slight, marked, or moderate. Numerical values provide a practical means of expressing and calculating the extent of permanent impairment and encourage accurate, equitable, and uniform evaluation. And I would stress that last term, uniform evaluation. The methods of calculating impairment are uniform, are explained in detail with examples, and require a minimum of computation. Now, generally, when a single impairment is involved, the percentage value may be read directly from the text or transposed to a relative value of either the body or the whole man by referring to appropriate tables. When the guides were developed in 1971, the foreword stated, and I quote, during the past 14 years, physicians and others have requested over 225,000 reprints of the individual guides. And I think this certainly shows that they are well accepted in the medical community and are being used. The forward assures that the guides are reviewed periodically to ensure their continued value. Now, the Oregon Workman's Compensation Board is familiar with and has used the guides in evaluating permanent impairment. For example, on page 37 of the board's answer to the executive department, they did the study, you know, last fall, and the board responded to the study. And apparently, one of the recommendations, I think it was recommendation 4-2, adopt the disability evaluation determination system used by the United States Veterans Administration. Well, the board in part responded to the reference to the American Medical Association guide and did say, in all areas, the American Medical Association guide is less complicated, more understandable, more familiar to all persons engaged in rating disability, and is used in almost all workman's compensation jurisdictions. I might point out they didn't imply that they were used exclusively, but they are used. And then the board said the board challenges the statement that the U.S. code can be readily adopted in Oregon. Now, the National Study Commission, on page 69 of its recommendation, speaking of the AMA guides, referred to it as a basis for a rational evaluation of injury or disease.
1973, Joe Markey, Executive Secretary of the California Self-Insurers Association, speaking on the subject of permanent partial disability, said, to calculate the percentage of physical impairment, we recommend that the AMA guides to the evaluation of impairment be considered. We believe that it will provide a more uniform approach to evaluations on our present disability rating schedule. In support of this recommendation, we have noted that the National Study Commission report contains the following statement. In part, use of the AMA publication instead of statutory scheduling appears desirable. So we believe that the AMA guides to the evaluation of permanent impairment should be statutorily adopted for use in Oregon. One other thing I might point out is that Nevada depends very heavily on the use of the AMA guides, and with some success. I would like to read to you a brief statement with respect to their evaluation of the use of these guides. It's by Dr. Richard Hall, and I'll leave a copy with the committee. Dr. Hall stated, two features of the Nevada system enhance the reasonableness of the evaluation as well as tending to reduce the manifestations of disability. Since many traumatic residual impairments do not in fact reach an end point, there is great pressure to include in the evaluation some estimate of future deterioration. Immediately, the evaluation becomes subjective and more practically becomes an appropriate subject for legal argument and litigation. In Nevada, with unlimited reopening privileges available in case of need either for further treatment or for rehabilitation or vocational change, the evaluator is concerned only with the objective, measurable impairment factors present at the time of claim closure. By limiting impairment evaluations to objectively measured factors, the opportunity for litigation is severely diminished. This is thought to be an extremely important factor, ensuring the maximum flow of monies available to the claimant thereafter, rather than diversion for legal encounters. Likewise, it allows the dollar values to be altered by legislative change without restructuring the underlying system. And the second and very attractive feature of the Nevada system which enhances the PPD award system is a vigorous and liberal rehab service operated within the workman's compensation structure itself. This ensures consideration of the whole matter of vocational readjustment outside of the PPD assessment. Since the burden is shared by the claimant, that is, his or her cooperation is necessary for success, even for the availability of funds, there is no premium upon the posture or attitude of disability. Quite the opposite. This service is currently being implemented with a well-funded physical rehab center and services. The accent will be upon early intervention. That sounds familiar, doesn't it, Mr. Chairman? So I think what he's saying is that if they try to take the subjectivity out of the determination of permanent partial disability, and you certainly do that by the adoption of the AMA guides. Now, I'd like to give you copies of the materials we have, and we have some proposed amendments which Mr. Kuhn will explain to you and also give the fiscal impact of this measure.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Roy Green. I'm here also representing Associated Oregon Industries. Incidentally, for the record, I'm not a hired gun. It's for free.
He reminds me of that periodically. But you drink at St. Helens.
If you refer to Senate Bill 1049 on page 2, line 11, we have proposed an amendment to delete 100 and insert 75.
It was my understanding that we had agreed to $100 a degree. Maybe, perhaps I'm wrong, but it was my understanding that this was the reason we included it. That was part of the agreement that we'd increase it to $100 a degree. Now, I don't know. Don't look puzzled.
I am puzzled by that because I don't recall it making that statement.
Okay, go ahead. On page 4, line 2, after the item 3, delete except as provided in subsection 4 of this section, any, and insert the word and any capitalized. Then delete lines 8 through 21 on page 4. This takes out the area of loss of wages. We've been informed by personnel from the department, the insurance commissioner's office, that the cost of the paragraph that is being deleted by our amendment is approximately 151% increase in rates, and that the cost of the bill as such is 158% increase in rates. And this is the main reason for our deletion of that paragraph.
State that again. What was your main reason?
The paragraph which has been deleted, according to the insurance commissioner's office, will require an approximate 151% rate increase, and the total bill, including that, would be 158% rate increase.
For just permanent partial?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. What increase would this be for overall as far as...
That is the rate increase, period.
The increase for permanent partial disability alone, I believe, is in excess of 400%.
Okay. Anything further?
No other question?
Chairman?
Senator Carson?
Some of the handouts, I'm assuming that the handouts that were given to us all came from you,
yes.
One of you. I was looking at this one that shows comparative cases. If I read this correctly, the present rating at $70, if we adopt the whole man rating per the AMA, in most cases there appears to be a drop in benefit to the workman. If we go to $100 but stay with the AMA, then in some cases there's a drop, in some cases there is an increase. I think in most cases there is
a sheet.
That's about the same.
Mm-hmm.
If I understand you correctly, you're recommending we take the whole man bill, and you're supporting it. Takes the AMA whole man guideline too.
Exclusively for the determination of PPD.
Okay. But that's what this chart relates to, doesn't it?
These are five in each area, five selected scheduled injuries and five unscheduled injuries. The way the AMA guide works, apparently, those injuries to the arm and hands and fingers are far more highly recompensed for than you'll find in feet and legs and toes.
Well, the one that particularly struck my, got my attention was the difference between what we're paying now for low back and what we'd pay under 100. Well, I guess what I'm getting at is it would seem to me that at least cost to, we could go that $100 and leave that and stay with the AMA and the workman gets about the same benefit up and down on some, as you point out, maybe a little more on hands and fingers, a little less on low back, which is kind of an interesting thing. But the workman gets about the same, and the cost, I guess, to the system would be about the same. So I was wondering why you wanted to go back to 75. Just cost savings? Is that the... Okay.
I'd like to point out on these specific cases, they were worked out by the evaluation division of the board.
Are they representative, as best you can tell?
Yes, they're just selected. You'll note that number 10, the low back, is 5% unscheduled. Shows quite a different answer than number 6, which is a 10% unscheduled. And their evaluation was that that would make a whole man rating of 5%. So you have a little different evaluation under the current set of facts. And that also includes, as I understand, wage loss, additional benefit for wage loss.
Which one does, I'm sorry?
Present rating at 70%, column 3.
I see. And the whole man rating per AMA does not, then?
No, that does not.
Senator Carson, Michael Lamb is here, who did the actuarial from the insurance division. I think it would be well if we questioned him. Could we pull another chair up, Mr. Lamb, and would you...
Are you done with us? We'll be happy to leave.
I think if you might remain there, if we have any other questions that we can... I believe that's for best. Okay, Senator Carson, I think that some of those questions...
Well, I'm just trying to see if I understood the chart correctly. Mr. Lamb, you've seen the exhibit that was distributed to us that compares the present rating at 70, the whole man rating per AMA at 70, and the whole man rating per AMA at 100. I assume they're representative, and I just noticed that we could do what the bill states, that's go to $100, and but then adopt the AMA, and we really haven't, it's a mixed bag, but we really haven't apparently increased the benefits very much to the workmen, in some cases decreased them, and I'm assuming that would be directly reflected, or at least in part reflected, on the rates. So it seemed to me that we could go to 100 in the AMA and not be in much a different position than we are at 70 in our present standard.
Mr. Senator, I haven't seen this before, and I don't know how representative it is of a total of permanent partial claims. And arriving at my estimates of the cost of this bill, I first of all figured the change of increasing the award per degree from $70 to $100 and came up with an overall increase of about 7.3%. And
7.3%.
7.3, just for that one change from the 70 to 100, before any of the other changes in the bill. I then went on to the addition of the loss of wages.
Excuse me, did you consider what appears to be, and I'm really ignorant in this area, that it appears to be the adoption of the AMA standards take you back? There'd be a reduction. Now, I'm concluding that. I don't know that. Did you take that into consideration?
I didn't get that far. Once I'd done the loss of wages, the percent was so high, and there's so much uncertainty in that because the sensitivity of the assumptions that I didn't bother to go any farther.
Okay, thank you.
It would be possible to probably get a comparison of on a larger basis of what the change in due to the AMA guides would be. It would require some clerical work.
Well, Mr. Chairman, could we ask you
what do you see the costs right now, the bill as it now stands? What's going to happen to the rates if the bill goes into effect, as you see it?
I provided to the Budget Management Division of the Executive Department an estimate of that rates would increase of approximately 158%.
158%. I thought the gentleman from the AOI said 200 and some percent.
No.
400 and some if we left 100.
Well, the impact on permanent partial claims only is, about 440%. And permanent partial claims are a little over a third of the total cost of the workman's compensation claim, so it comes out to about 158% overall.
158% overall. Now, is that taking into consideration some of the changes that we've made in the permanent total disability, that we're going to be saving money and would be decreasing the rates?
Well, no, that's the impact of this bill only.
On this bill only, I see.
This
bill is part of a package of bills designed to work in the area of work.
No, I didn't phrase it that way.
Well, I think that's true, right, Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Any further questions? If not, thank you. Bob Kennedy, and does Jim Mitchum want to come up with the same? Or Jim, do you want to speak on that? Fine. Let Jim Mitchum first, and if you want to wait there.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Mitchum. I represent the National Electrical Contractors Association. I want to apologize for not being able to testify on the last hearing on Senate Bill 1048. The reason I am here today is to thank the committee for their efforts on workman's compensation and express our association's support of these efforts. I thought it would also be applicable to give some figures that would best exemplify why we are concerned. I contacted the state of Washington and compared their workman's comp rates with those of the state of Oregon. At the present time, in the state of Washington, as of with the 19th, the July increase, it would be $2.81 per $100 of gross payroll for a journeyman, inside wireman, or commonly known as an electrician. That same rate in the state of Oregon is $4.23. I'd also like to add that these type of rates do add up fast when your average hourly wage for a journeyman inside wireman is $14 per hour. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? If not, thank you.
Thank you.
Bob Kennedy, AFL-CIO.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, committee members. Bob Kennedy, president of the Oregon AFL-CIO. The Oregon AFL-CIO is pleased that this committee is giving serious consideration to the loss of wages for permanent partial disabilities. In fact, there is a loss of wages in addition to permanent partial impairment benefits. And this area has needed attention for quite a long time. Now, I've been told by a hearings officer and a Court of Appeals judge that they have granted permanent total disability awards to persons that are really only permanent partial disabilities. Because of the present statutes, there has been no consideration for the loss of earnings. Because of this, I feel very strongly that the cost increase will not be as great as the employer representatives fear by giving benefits based on actual wage loss. And when I'm referring to that, I'm talking about the total overall cost to the employer, not just to this one area, because you'd be foolish to think that giving consideration to loss of wages on this would not be raising the cost on this in this one area. The National Commission on State Workmen's Compensation Laws, on pages 68 and 69 of the 1972 report, and the U.S. Department of Labor of Interdepartmental Workers' Compensation Task Force to the President and Congress of the Policy Group, dated 1-1977, pages 5 and 6, agree on wage laws. And quoting from the latter report, quote, although the permanent disability and death cases constitute only about 5% of the workers' compensation claims, they are responsible for about 50% of the benefit payments. And with respect to those cases, we find excessive litigation, long delays in payment, high subsequent rates of persons without employment, and little relationship between the benefits awarded and actual wage loss, unquote. And I might add that our high unemployment figure that we have here in Oregon does not help in this area. And continuing to quote, a major part of the problem is caused by the settlement system, which focuses on terminating the liability of the carriers and employers either by compromise and release or by lump sum or weeks of benefits arrangement, which attempts to foretell the amount of wage loss that will be sustained by a person with a specific type and degree of impairment. Studies for the task force indicated that estimates are subject to large error. In other words, their principles of reform, this analysis leads to one of the main recommendations of the policy group. They propose that compensation for wage loss be separated from any other benefits provided by workers' compensation, and these wage replacements be paid as the wage loss accrues. And in one stroke, this recommendation greatly increases both the equity and the adequacy of benefits. Compensation will be directly related to the losses as they occur, and so long as compensation is not arbitrarily limited in amount or duration, benefits will continue in parallel with need. Moreover, without the reliance on future estimates of losses, determination of the amount of benefits should be accomplished with much less controversy. With wage loss as the main element of compensability, there is increased incentive for the system to help claimants meet one of the other goals of workers' compensation, without jobs or with lower income, are drawing benefits, and those who have returned to work at former earnings are not, unquote. We in the Oregon AFL-CIO agree with the above portion of the report. The NCSWCL report supports the impairment benefits, and I quote, impairment benefits are justified because of losses an impaired worker experiences that are unrelated to lost remuneration. The impairment may, for example, have lifetime effects on the personality and normal activities of the worker, unquote. In 1976, as per Mr. Carl Jacobson of the Workmen's Compensation Board, there were 33,431 disabling injuries, of which these were more than 3 days' duration. Of these, there were 7,249 permanent partial disabilities of varying degrees. The Guide to Evaluation of Permanent Impairment, published by the American Medical Association, are inadequate in our estimation to fairly evaluate a workman's compensation claim. It is possible for a person to do all the motions in the AMA guide, which would then, on paper, appear that the patient was okay, but in fact could not lift 10 pounds from the floor. The Oregon AFL-CIO is offering the amendments which are attached to this testimony. We prefer that the present schedule be used in determining impairment benefits. As an illustration, in the present system, for the loss of a hand, you would get $10,500. And now I ask any one of you who will sell a hand for this amount, even though it would not affect your wages. And I doubt that any one of you would. The lifetime effects on experiences, normal activities, and personality, to say nothing of the pain the person experiences for the rest of his or her life, in this case, because of the problems with and caused by the appliance that he or she may be fitted with to help them perform a job. Now, my wife's uncle experienced some of this type of a situation when he had lost an arm, and he had problems with that thing until the day that he died. The balance of our proposed amendments are what we consider clarifications. Moving to the amendments, on page 2 of the printed bill, we would suggest that the lines 13 through 35. On page 3,
did you say delete?
Yes, sir. You're talking about deleting lines 13 through 35. Really, what we're talking about doing is keeping the present statutes.
They already deleted?
It's already deleted in the...
Yeah.
Yeah, it's already deleted.
Oh, I'm sorry. We're talking about deleting from the this bill and keep the present...
We mean putting them back.
Oh. Yes, sir.
Reinstating.
Restoring all these degrees.
Yes, I'm sorry. This...
You'd want to restore that material that has been deleted in this.
Okay. I've used the wrong... Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then on page 3, we would restore line 1 through 34. And then on page 4, restore line 1.
Okay.
In line 3, after quote of, delete the rest of line...
Where is line 3 on page 4?
Yes, on page 4.
Delete what there, Bob?
After the word of, delete the rest of the line and line 4 and insert physical impairment plus loss of earning capacity. In line 5, delete medical association. In line 8, delete may and insert shall. On line 10, after disability, insert to be computed on an annual basis. And the reason for that is so that it would be current. In line 11, delete clear and convincing and insert preponderance of. In line 14, after income, insert excluding earnings on investments. And the reason for that, if we feel that if some person has made some investments prior to his injury, why he should not be, this should not be figured in and held against him on his loss of wages or earnings. In line 16, delete wages and insert earnings. In line 17, after wages, delete the rest of the sentence and insert, the worker would have received had the injury not occurred. In line 18, delete wages and insert earnings. In line 21, delete reduction and insert adjustment. And the reason for that is the adjustment could be made either way. Who knows? And with these amendments, the Oregon AFL-CIO would request favorable consideration on Senate Bill 1049.
Okay, any questions by members of the committee? Yes, Senator
Roberts.
Thank you. On line, on page four, lines 18 through 21, even with the changes, I was wondering whether or not you would interpret that to mean that if a workman became injured and there, after a period of time, they were able to work perhaps part-time and receive some wages that they would, that those, or some earnings, that those earnings would be compared to the original wage, which might be not the same in terms of actual dollar value to the individual involved. In other words, well, if you're going to try to compare the previous wage some time back to the present earnings capacity, are you going to consider other factors besides the simple dollar amount of that wage?
Well, where you can, if I understand you correctly, I think, or anyway, the way I'm getting your question, are you, our idea is that what they should be getting is, we realize that some people get cost of living adjustments or whatever else. Now, this is being very arbitrary, there's no two ways about it, because of the fact that, who knows to what levels of that this person might have raised themselves should they not been hampered by the impairment. We would hope that the employers, when they would be making this adjustment, would not on the first dollar that make the adjustment. However, this would state that they could, because of the fact that you're going to find some folks who are going to say, well, what's the use of trying to work when it's you work for nothing, you might say. So I think the employers would have to be very careful about that particular situation. I think the more I think about your question, are you referring to such benefits as maybe that they might have had because maybe they might have only be working now part-time, and then they would might not qualify for fringe benefits such as medical, dental,
but the other
all those.
And the other thing, too, is simply that someone who's making a particular amount per month at a job prior to the injury, if this, you know, years and years later, and they're still making the old wage, when you take a look at inflation and the value of that original wage, it's considerably less than it would be at the time it was reevaluated. And you know, I'm just kind of concerned as to what effect this particular language would have in interpreting what that individual is entitled to. If you're talking about the old wage rate or the old, and I know you change it from wages to earnings, I'm trying to get at that as solved that problem or not.
Well, in my mind, the word, when we were talking about the word actual, this would, and maybe someone else might disagree, which I'm sure that they probably would, but when we're talking about the actual loss weight of earnings, this would have to be geared to what the job that the person was doing. And as I say, we're being arbitrary to say that they would still be doing that same job, because if possible, they might have been doing a higher rated job, which would carry more remuneration. But that actual would be as to what that job was paying now, not the time the person was injured.
So what that job would be paying at current rate, please.
That is correct. Maybe someone else might, well, it doesn't, that's my interpretation of actual. However, to clarify it, maybe we'd need some other language then to take care of that particular problem.
Thank you.
Senator Crow?
Yeah.
Bob, do you have any idea what your suggested amendments would do to the rates to the employers?
No, I do not, because as I stated earlier, because of having been told by these persons I had mentioned earlier, because we know that they have made permanent totals out of some people, and those, when you do that, we know the cost of permanent totals are very expensive. And I see that by moving in this area, this will save some of those. And I don't know how many of those have happened. I can appreciate that these people would not be wanting to advertise. They have done something that maybe was not kosher, but the fact remains, we know that it has, and I just don't know. I think this would help to move us into the area where we would have more permanent partials and considerably less permanent totals.
Do you think in the long run, with the kind of compromises envisioned in the other pieces of legislation, that this would save money for the employers still, that rates would be reduced?
Well, it's I really don't have a crystal ball, and I just honestly don't know. It was when we were talking about the high amounts of that has been presented earlier in the testimony, I don't know how these people would know what jobs some of these folks would become involved in. And I know in some cases it's going to help some people. On the other hand, there's going to be some people that would be unhappy that they would be cut off because of the award that they had been given, because this will cut some of those people off once their earnings are up. And I don't know how many of those people are already earning more or equal to the job they presently or had held and at the new rate.
Senator Jern said?
Just an observation. If what you say is true, and I certainly believe it is, then the Workman's Compensation Board has not been living up anywhere near to the letter of the law, and this might be one of the reasons why the rates are so high now.
Well, I can't comment on that. I don't know whether they are or not. I know that I've stated that some people have been doing some things that possibly was not as to the letter of the law, but on the other hand, they do have some latitude, and it's on the other hand, the carriers do have the opportunity to take issue if they disagree, and the employer as well.
And that costs too. So.
Yes, it does.
Any further questions? If there's someone here from the Workman's Compensation Board, maybe they could answer your question.
I don't think they'd want it.
Thank you.
Okay. We have no further witnesses. I'm going to ask the same committee that we appointed last time, which was for Labor, LB Day, Bob Kennedy, George Lewis, then Management, Carl Frederick, Jack Kalinowski, Roy Green, and Cliff Trull and myself, and we'll have staff set up a meeting shortly, and we're going to ask also in attendance or be those from Workman's Comp Board as well as SAFE. And as soon as we possibly can, we will have a meeting of this subcommittee, which, and if staff would do this as quickly as possible. Incidentally, we have 1048. We've had a meeting on that, and this bill is ready to go and should be before the committee shortly in a work session. Okay, let's return to Senate Bill 430.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Ye
the rest
they're
of
all,
them.
They're all gone.
Is this the one? Is this the minutes where the athlete?
I can't see it.
We have three sets of amendments that have been offered, too. I could go through them if you want.
Let's go through them the first time.
And do we have all of them, Rich?
Amendments?
There are three sets of amendments to 430. One is on committee letterhead dated April 11th. One is on committee letterhead dated February 24th and deals with amateur athletes. And then a legislative council draft dated February 21 that refers to farms. These are the...
I have just two.
I just have...
The, it's somewhere under the pile. I think it got passed out.
Here's the...
I think it got passed out early and it's probably buried under your papers right now.
Why don't you go through them? Begin the one on, and let's take action. The one on the amateur athletes.
Okay. We have received an amendment. That's a request of the Portland Winterhawks. It's on committee letterhead dated February 24th. It amends the bill by including among the exemptions from subject workmen covered by the workmen's compensation laws, amateur athletes, meaning a person who has been declared an amateur athlete under the rules of the American Olympic Committee or the Canadian Olympic Committee and who receives no remuneration other than board, rent, housing, lodging, or other reasonable incidental subsistence allowance.
We have someone here from the Winterhawks that represents Winterhawks. Would you come forward and
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Just a question.
Senator Jones said?
Well, if amendments of the on the committee letterhead were adopted, would this amendment proposed by the Winterhawks be necessary?
It would be to exempt the Winterhawks from the comp laws. As I understand the situation, the Workman's Compensation Board has found that the players for the Winterhawks are workmen and have asked the Winterhawks to pay compensation premiums on them. So, yes, the amendments are in conflict, but the amendment could be worked in the same bill. Yeah. No, unless there is an exemption made, as I understand the current situation, the Winterhawks will be considered workmen and will be paying compensation. Mr. Bach probably can fill you in.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. My name is Richard Bach. I'm a lawyer with the Portland firm of Reeves, Bonahetti, Drummond, and Smith, and I'm here today on behalf of the Portland Winterhawks. To answer Senator Jernstedt's question, I have a letter here from the State Accident Insurance Fund, dated March 29, 1977. I'd be pleased to furnish copies of this letter at a later time, but I quote from one paragraph of the letter, which was in response to a telephone conversation that I had with a representative of SAIF. And Mr. Morley, an underwriting manager for the underwriting division of SAIF, said to me in this letter, in our conversation, it was agreed that if the proposed amendment, which is the amendment we have before this committee, making amateur athletes such as the Portland Winterhawks non-subject workmen is passed, we will not make any attempt at collection for the present season for the players. However, if this amendment does not become law, we will then retroactively assess premium on the assumed wage of $867 per month for the players. And I might add that they're assessing a rate of something in the order of $23 per hundred of payroll for this category.
Little payroll? What's a payroll? I mean...
Well, that's, Senator Groner, that's one of the problems we're having with SAIF. We don't have a payroll for these boys. They don't receive any wages. However, SAIF, under the statute, has the power to determine what it feels ought to be an appropriate payroll for employees, and it has arbitrarily established this assumed wage of $867 a month. And they tell me that that's based on what they believe to be the value of what the team provides to them in their subsistence allowance, training, insurance, and other items.
There's someone value here from SAFE that could answer this. Chuck?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
No, is that for a 12-year period or just during the season? I mean, 12-month period. I'm sorry.
Just during the season, the playing season.
There are a number of areas.
Mr. Chairman,
I'm Charles Gill from the State Accident Insurance Fund. There are a number of areas of employment that don't provide actual payroll, but provide other considerations for the task that the employees might take. When it's considered that they are employees under the law and there is no payment of the normal payroll, you develop an assumed wage to collect premiums on. And you usually develop assumed wage considering like wages paid for the same kinds of activities. You also develop an assumed wage that's going to generate the kind of premiums and the level of wages that will develop the maximum benefits for those employees. Many of the benefits are based upon what the wages are of the individual. So in computing that, a number of considerations are taken into in thought. And in this particular area, apparently the underwriting department came up with an assumed wage of $800 and some odd a month.
Are there other classifications you do this in? This,
oh yeah.
Besides athletes, can you give an example?
Well, there's a lot of volunteer work that's
volunteer
covered.
Volunteer firemen and...
Yes, right. And you have to develop an assumed wage in order to establish some basis to collect premium because there's no payroll involved at all. But people want them covered or they're required to be covered by the law. In the case of volunteer firemen, there's an election that we want them covered. And so you develop an assumed wage. In this case, the problem here is that they've been considered interpretation under the law that they are employees.
What is your feeling in this regard?
My feeling is that I'd like to see the problem solved.
In which manner? I mean, as a matter of equity.
If there is a agreement between the players and the Winter Hawks that's not a problem, and I presume that they might have some other type of insurance program that I would like to see the Winter Hawks problem solve. That does amount to an awful lot of money for them to pay, that those rates are high. As you can imagine, when you're in a sports program, the injuries occur quite frequently, but most of both the professional and the amateur programs usually have some kind of good medical program to take care of that. And so unless there's a complaint by the players, I would like to see the Winter Hawks relieved of this rather costly area of insurance in an amateur field.
Senator Trow, did you have a question?
I was going to ask just about these athletes. Do they tend to be Oregon citizens like they stay and work in the state?
No, Senator, not at all. These are all Canadian citizens.
All Canadians.
At some time in the future, there might be an opportunity to have some American players on the team, but that's very unlikely I would say, for the next 5 or 10 years at least. These are all Canadian boys. They're all Canadian citizens. This team, up until this year, played as the Edmonton Oil Kings out of Edmonton. This year they transferred the franchise down to Portland. They're hoping in the future to perhaps have some other American franchises in the Western Canada Hockey League, but that's still off in the future. This is the first time there's ever been an American team.
Good insurance for them so that they're covered in terms of injuries.
Excellent, Senator. not only does the team carry complete medical insurance on them, but as Canadian citizens, these boys are all eligible for all of the Canadian welfare programs, the National Health Insurance from Canada, and also the other national programs in Canada. I might...
Senator Jernstead.
I'd like to ask Chuck Gillen a question. If we took this far enough, wouldn't it be possible for you or somebody to make a determination that a boy going to Oregon State University on a football or basketball scholarship, that would be in lieu of, and you could start, unless we pass this amendment, in the near future, you could decide that they should be paying in insurance fund too.
Yes, sir, that could. It wouldn't be, of course, me that would be making that determination. It's
what's the difference?
Well, somebody would be making the determination. It's true. It'd probably be the court to decide that they're an employee. I guess there's a fine line. Sometimes in amateur sports, whether they're, if they do receive remuneration, whether they are actually being paid and subject to the law. Now, that's a consideration that this body has to make. One other point on the assumed wage is the assumed wage is made in the sports area the other way, too. We make an assumed wage not to charge too much. If we didn't have an assumed wage, for instance, on Bill Walton, the premiums would be kind of heavy. So it works usually the assumed wage the other way to keep the costs down.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Carson.
Does that mean those of us that are under the assumed wage are paying Bill Walton's fair share of workman's comp? No, it's just what you said. I just wondered if that's what you meant.
No, I didn't. That there are some wages that are paid that are far in excess of the exposure that you would have for an individual. And so there's a limitation on some areas of employers and employees, that corporate officers and self-employed people.
Do you pay lost wages on the basis of the assumed?
Yes, we do. Okay. Yes, we do.
Yes. Good.
My back's been hurting me.
I'd move the amendment. Okay. Senator Crowe moves we adopt the amendment, the Winterhawks amendment. Is there any objection? Hearing none, it is so ordered. Now you want to go through the next amendment?
Which one do you want him next? You got two.
We ought to deal with the most comprehensive
amendment.
We ought to deal with the most comprehensive amendment because it'd be silly to adopt some of these others and then obliterate them with a subsequent amendment.
Okay, let's go to April 11th.
So as I understand the committee's intent, it's the intent of the committee to, in any regard, exempt amateur athletes, and it may require redrafting the bill, but it can there would be no conflict, you know, by putting on it, even if the bill was in one amendment stripped the bill, we'd be still able to create a new section to the bill in which amateur athletes would be.
No, what I'm talking about is if we took the farm amendment
I agree. The amendment on committee letterhead dated April 11th, 1977, deletes the bill as written and substitutes new language dealing with contractual relationships in the construction business area. Notwithstanding ORS 656027, which is the laundry list of exemptions, if any person engaged in a construction business lets a contract involving the performance of labor in that construction business, all individuals engaged in the performance of such labor pursuant to the contract or any subcontract thereunder shall be considered subject workers of the person letting the contract. Unless coverage for workers' compensation benefits has been secured for such individuals in the manner provided in the workmen's compensation laws by the individuals themselves or by the person with whom the individuals have a contract or subcontract relationship. And it goes on to define construction business in the typical way that it's defined throughout ORS. The intent behind this amendment is to in the area of construction business because of the hazards, to look beyond the employer-employee relationship and to require the prime contractor in a construction business to carry workers' comp on all persons working under him, either by contract or subcontract, unless the individuals themselves have elected coverage for themselves, or the person who is immediately above them has covered them by workman's comp. Realistically, this applies to, a pattern of business that has been developing in the construction business of many branching pyramids of contract, subcontract, subcontract. All workmen under that pyramid of branching subcontracts initially claiming that they're independent contractors, and there has been a problem of these people, when they're injured, filing a claim. And under present law, we really don't have a complying subject, or we don't have a subject employer that the board can look to for a recapture of past compensation payments, because under the independent contractor situation, there is not an employer-employee relationship, and therefore the law has not been covering them. This is a method to look at the contractual relationships and use that as a basis for workman's comp responsibility. Washington State and several other states, although I haven't looked at all 50, do have a similar provision for the construction trade.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask a few questions?
Yes, Senator Carson.
Excuse my ignorance, but is the present status of the law that an independent contractor, subcontractor, clearly independent, no game plan, he's one-man independent subcontractor, he's a painter, he has no workman's comp, can he then, if injured on the job, make a claim against?
He can make a claim, and then the board, of course, is going to determine whether he really was a bona fide subcontractor.
Well, if he were a bona fide subcontractor,
whatever that means, I suppose that.
Well, these are words that we're throwing around like we knew what they meant. I'm going to come to that in a minute here, but assuming that we know what construction business is, we know what lets means, which I think is the reverse of what we intended, and a few other things. But assume that we know what bona fide means. If he is truly, in my fact situation, an independent contractor, he is not covered by workman's comp.
That's correct.
And so there is no subject employer.
That's correct.
So there's no payment. So it's only the hiatus is where the two, the contractor and the subcontractor, determine their independent contractor, and the subcontractor is injured, and ultimately the board determines it was not an independent contractor relationship. It was too truly an employer-employee. Then you've got the problem. Isn't that where you have
the problem then of not having a subject employer, so the cost of that person's workman's comp is spread over the system. Well, you cannot recapture from any.
Is it possible to have a claim with no subject? Is it possible to be an employee if there is no subject employer?
Well, there's a lot of expertise in the audience. I think we probably should defer.
Thank God. I
couldn't.
George Moore or
Dick Miller is here from the Compliance Division.
Miller.
Thank you, Rich. I didn't mean to badger you.
No, it's a complicated area, and I would hate to.
I'd like to badger the chairman, but I just didn't.
You know, it's like to be badgered yesterday.
Yes, I got full measure yesterday. I'm trying to get even, is what I'm trying to do. Yeah, it's just my opinion.
Okay, Dick. I have not seen the amendment, but this is just
general law. Yes. I'm interested in.
Under normal circumstances, if you have a bona fide independent contractor, his claim would be submitted if that employer or the prime contractor were a covered employer. That independent contractual relationship would result in any claim that he filed being denied by the insurer.
Okay, let me ask you, Dick, this amendment was sent over to you 2 weeks ago, and you say you haven't seen it yet?
Well, I haven't seen the updated version.
This was sent over to you. It's an updated version, I believe, was sent over to you 2 weeks ago.
How could it when it's dated April 11th?
The problem I have, Senator, is that, as Mr. Wyman will recognize, Cliff Allison worked on it, and I have not seen the amendment. We talked about it, yes. I was in on the meeting.
Well, we had a meeting 2 weeks ago, and
yes,
we sat down and worked out something that you felt was
right,
workable, yes.
The amendment, as I understand Mr. Wyman describing it.
Well, let me give you a copy.
Yeah.
All right.
A copy. Let him read it. Don't take long.
I have two more questions, and I don't know whether I ask Richard or
let him read the amendment first there. And I think
yes, this is the amendment that was discussed in the meeting, and in essence, any subcontractor would be, he in his own right would be responsible for his workmen and necessarily subject to the workman's compensation law. This amendment would provide that that subcontractor, sole proprietor, partner, or corporation, or corporate officer, would have to elect coverage under the law and premium be paid on him as a subcontractor and as a contributor. If he did not, the prime contractor would be responsible for his coverage. Consequently, he would have coverage, and any injury would be, it, within the course and scope of the employment, would be compensable.
So if I understand the amendment, Mr. Chairman, if I may,
yes,
if I understand sure, the sure. Part of the amendment, whether you're an independent contractor or not, it makes no difference in the construction field. If you're in the construction business, you better be covered by workman's comp.
That's right. If you do not provide it, then the prime contractor is responsible to provide it on your behalf.
Okay. One further question, and this may be a Richard or to our witness. If a person engaged in the construction business lets a contract, my experience with usually it's the owner that lets the contract, and lets is kind of an archaic phrase, but what are we trying to get at there? We're just saying enters a contract or...
Yeah, I wish that Chuck Wilson had stayed. I assume that he would. This was drafted by legislative council, although it's on our letterhead.
I'm not trying to place blame. I'm trying to find out what's going on.
I really don't know why he chose let's and whether it is an appropriate word. The intent of the amendment is to hinge it on someone who is in a construction business entering in or letting or giving out a contract so that the homeowner who wants a
that's the
closet
point.
Built is not, the homeowner is not in the in a construction business.
Okay.
However, in the
Chuck now.
Just heard his name mentioned.
We're going to nail you, Chuck, on the
wall. No. Just wondering why he's using 18th century language here.
What have we got?
If a person engaged in construction business lets a contract, usually it's the owner that lets a contract, isn't it?
That's where I got that way.
Because it was there.
Well, it's not as old as I thought it was. It's only 1957 language. I'm sorry.
Whatever, if you...
Well, okay.
If you've got a...
No.
I don't mean to...
I'm going
to
quit. Everybody's so paranoid this morning. I'm just trying to get along here. What you mean is that you, and Richard mentioned it, I want to make sure that an owner of a house who hires a contractor doesn't pick up the rather heavy burden that the workman's comp, that this would be required of everybody, that we're talking about the contractor on down, that the person who let the contract, which is normally the owner, as I understand it, if that's to which it, the activity to which it applies,
Well, we had a talk about it, and I think that the representatives of the compensation board felt that it would not pick up the homeowner. However, that the committee might be wanting to consider a specific exemption.
Well, it's nobody's intent to pick up the homeowner.
No, it was not.
It
our
was
intent.
Felt that.
No.
Excuse me. It was felt the intent, or our discussion was, it was felt that construction business would still leave in the exemption under 656027 sub 2, which says a workman employed is not subject. A workman employed to do gardening, maintenance, repair, remodeling, or similar work in or about the private home of the person employing him.
Well, okay, but what I'm thinking, I think it's obvious, and I apologize to the committee and the witnesses for and counsel for belaboring it, but let's say I want to build a house. and I hire a contractor, that doesn't require any, and it's cost plus or contract price. It's not an employee relationship. It's purely contract, independent contractor. I'm as a homeowner, I'm picking up no responsibility for workman's comp. Now, if this bill passes, the interplay between the contractor and subcontractors will be directly affected.
Right.
But I'm not going to pick up.
My understanding is that it does not reach you because you are not in the construction business yourself. You have engaged a prime to build that for you. You're buying a product.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Jernstedt.
Under the wording of this amendment, if during the session Mr. Carson wants his house painted, and he hires me to do it, would either one of us come under the cost of workman's comp?
No, that's you're excluded under the provision that I just read, which is in the bill, by the way, sub 2 of the bill, or in that statute.
However, if you hired someone to put out the storm windows on Mr. Carson's house, you would be responsible for the comp payments on the person that you contracted with to do part of the work.
But if he hired me to do it, would I have to pay workman's comp?
I think it hinges on whether you're in a construction business.
I would be if I was doing the work.
Well, it puts the responsibility on the person who lets the contract. In other words,
you would have to pay it.
Well, if he was in a construction business.
Yeah, we can't rely on 027 because 027 is specifically blocked by notwithstanding. So we can't. We've got to look. Whatever's in the construction business is in the construction business.
Yes.
And construction says alteration, repair, improvement. So I'd be inclined to think that Senator Jernstedt, Painter Jernstedt, would be included. Would he not?
It's not my understanding that he would be included. It's
clear that
in or about your private home, which is clearly under this statute, and I'll have to let the lawyers tell you about the notwithstanding.
You're really in trouble now.
Yeah.
Doesn't notwithstanding block 027?
Seems to me that it would.
So we're superimposing section 2 right on top of all the exemptions. And if you fit whatever we say in 027, you're going to be paying workman's comp, regardless of any other exemption in 027 that you might want to lean on. They're not available. So I think that Senator Jernstedt is going to have to, clearly, if he hires somebody to put on storm windows, then he's got a employer-employee relationship and he ought to pay workman's comp. But the issue is whether I hire him to paint my house. Then is he in the construction business? If he does one house a year, maybe he's not in the construction business. Maybe he's just a friendly neighbor that's doing it.
If I painted your house, it would be the only one I ever painted.
Senator <probably. laughs> Carson, I think what we may be looking at here is putting an express exemption for homeowners, which could be done in here. The problem that the bill addresses, the policy problem, is the large group of subcontractors, for instance, who will be working under a general contractor who will be engaged in a business. He'll be listed as a business, a construction business in the yellow pages.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he will have no employees. He never has any employees. He has. There might be 20 independent subcontractors floating from job to job.
That follow him around,
and occasionally, as I understand it, when they're hurt, do make claims, and it's hard to find. There is no subject employer in that situation.
Right.
So if one of these people does make a claim and the board determines that he was an employee as opposed to an independent contractor, where do you go for your remedy?
Well, if the person for whom he was doing work was covered, we present the claim to the carrier for acceptance or denial.
Mm-hmm.
If the person for whom he was working did not have coverage, and we determined an employment relationship, we would issue an order of non-compliance and refer the claim to the state accident to fund for processing, acceptance or denial.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Trow.
I move this amendment. Then we can further discuss it if we want to later.
Okay, Senator Trow has moved the adoption of the amendment dated April 11th. Is there any objection?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Is it is it appropriate to raise some further inquiry about some confusion in it?
I think not. At this time, we had a hearing on this.
Are we going to have a hearing on when we adopt this?
As it, yes.
Okay.
Is there any objection? Hearing none, it is so ordered.
And why don't we ask him what he sees wrong?
I think you've had a chance. You've testified in this bill before. Maybe not.
I addressed Mr. Chairman. I have never testified on the bill. I presented some written comments on the original version. This language, obviously, is substantially different.
That might do.
Okay. Do you wish to make some remarks on this?
It's a little more innovative than
that with the record.
Fred Bonata, on behalf of the Oregon State Home Builders Association, and I'm busy at this point trying to clearly understand what is covered by the language and what isn't. If I understand it correctly, if there is a contract to put a roof on a house, if I am a home builder and there's a contract to put a roof on the house, everybody that's involved in that firm that has the contract to put the roof on the house has got to have workman's compensation on themselves.
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay, if I have a contract to deliver, if I am a home builder and I contract with somebody to deliver lumber to the job site and they come out and unload it, must everybody who owns and operates that material supply establishment have workman's compensation on themselves?
I would think not. That has nothing to do with the construction itself.
A contract involving the performance of labor in a construction business.
Well, let me understand your question. You're asking whether the general contractor is responsible for the guy who comes out and unloads lumber?
Under the language...
I mean, is that your question?
Yes.
Okay, understanding your question, yes, I would think so, unless the person carried compensation on themselves or was an employee covered under someone else's compensation.
So the everybody involved in the material supply firm would have to carry workman's compensation, or the general contractor would have to carry it on them.
If they were at the, if they were performing labor under that contract. Now, obviously, the secretary back in the Office of the Material Building Supply Company is not performing under the construction contract.
Well, I'm trying to understand how far you are reaching with this legislation. There's the fundamental question. You're trying to get at the owners and operators of businesses and require them to carry workman's compensation on themselves, and when you get at it by talking about the performance of labor in the construction business.
Let me ask you this, Fred. How many builder suppliers do you know that fail to carry workman's comp that you do business, your people you represent do business with?
Well,
and what other, do you have any other examples of this that the people you do business with, besides the
The next example I was going to use.
Well, let's take how many, the first question, how many building supply people that are in the business are required to have workman's compensation?
Well,
and you know that.
If they are employees of a building supply company, they clearly are required to carry it. But if the owner of the firm delivers the material and unloads it on the job site, he is not, under present law, as I understand it, required to carry workers' compensation on himself. And as I understand this legislation, he would be required to carry it on himself, or the general contractor would be required to carry it on him.
Dick, do you have any answer to that supposition?
I think that perhaps that he's made a valid point. I think that, as Mr. Wyman just said, you should have sent a
that man delivered. Here you have a supplier of materials on a construction job and the delivery of those. I think it's possible.
If the owner is...
And revert right back to the owner and operator of that supply business, even though they never reached the job.
Okay.
Somebody doing my
the related question, and I want Senator Carson to listen carefully to this question, and it really applies to what is construction business. Let us take the next case that occurs to me as I sit here and try to think about what's involved in the construction business. Presume that I have an attorney on retainer to help fill out my permit forms and protect me from various harassing laws and regulations. Is he required, and he's on a regular contract retainer, for the performance of labor, is that performance of labor in the construction business, and is he required to carry workers' compensation on himself, or am I required to cover him as a home builder?
Let me interject here that there were two avenues that we looked at. One was linking it to construction business, and the other was linking it to construction site. Washington's law links it to construction site, which at this point might be a better way to go if we're worried about the compensation board running wild and trying to pull in everyone in the world. If we just change business to site, then you have a specific area, which of course is recognized in law for building permit and inspection purposes and would be easily identified.
Chairman.
Your way to go.
Senator Roberts.
It would seem to me that that would address part of the problem, but you might consider whether or not you need to also restrict it in terms of the labor performed. In other words, if you're going to relate it specifically to the construction, alteration, repair, improvement, moving, or demolition of the structure and appurtenance thereto, as in subsection 2 of section 2, you might want to indicate that it does not cover other activities such as the bringing of materials to the site by other than those involved in the construction, or it may not involve individuals whose labor is not exclusively related to that particular activity. I'm not sure.
I will not pursue the matter further, Mr. Chairman. I perhaps should.
It's certainly not the intent of the committee to include these. Deliver the material or an attorney that
we are
should, but I think that if they are included, and that it's not the intent of the committee to include them.
Well, we are.
What I'm going to ask you to do is, if you can meet with probably Senator Carson and see if you can't come up with a proper.
Okay, Senator, we are opposed, to make it very clear, we are opposed to the intent of the bill when you get down to that, and I am perhaps in error in nitpicking it. It would be better to send it in its worst form off to battle, because we do not believe that a businessman should be covered.
Do you people represent, the people you represent operate in that fashion, sub, to avoid payment of premium tax?
No.
Or payment of a workman's comp and...
No, but
well, then what are you worrying about?
If a individual businessman chooses not to cover himself, that should be his privilege. Now,
are you here before the committee representing your people, or are you representing this individual businessman?
Well, my people are individual businessmen, Senator.
My question first was, do you operate in this fashion? Do your people you represent operate in this fashion, sub for the, and pay no workman's comp, pay no TriMet tax?
At my last legislative committee meeting, I went around the table and said, how many of my people pay workman's compensation on themselves? About half of them do not. Now, I am a corporate officer in my own business. I happen to pay workman's compensation on myself because it's at the rate I pay as, in effect, a field representative, it's a good deal. But for employers on construction sites, they can get the protection they need other places less expensively. So, you know, the fundamental intent of trying to nail the owner and the operator and develop an assumed wage on him is a very hazardous business.
Nothing in this bill would...
The bill says anything about the owner or the contractor.
Would require the prime or the owner to pay compensation on themselves.
Right. But...
However, what it will do is to require that when we have a company with 20 or 25 independent contractors that floats from job to job, and then one of them gets hurt and runs to the compensation board, and they don't feel so much like an independent businessman at that point. Then we, you know, what we're dealing with is that sort of problem.
Dick, did you?
Trying to be an independent businessman until you're hurt, and then you want to be an employee.
Mr. Wyman, how many cases has the board had of this variety? I know there are some, but. I'd like to go back and correct another point that you make precisely. And I think what you're trying to do is the general home builder perhaps is not covered, but all the other independent businessmen on the job site under this would be covered. And I'm not sure what maybe is in the painting case, maybe even the general contractor's covered.
Well, it's a policy choice. It's a hazardous industry, and we're having a situation where we're finding more and more companies operating in this fashion, and it's a policy choice whether, you know, the use of groups of independent contractors and is a good policy or not.
It certainly
gives you approximately a 30% bidding advantage, so I understand why people are more and more...
Fred, I can't understand your concern when you testified just minutes ago that none of your people operate in this fashion or through this method of making everybody a sub and to avoid payment of workman's comp. I mean, what is your concern?
The point I was making, Senator, my people don't hire subcontractors for the point of avoiding the payment of workman's compensation. Lots of people in the construction business use subcontractors because there are literally hundreds of independent firms.
And if his subs has carries workman's comp, that's all that's necessary.
Well, but the point is, the question is, you're trying to cover the independent businessman. The employees are required to be covered by law today. And if there's a question about their coverage, there's ample remedy in the existing statute.
If they work on the job, they should be covered. It's a hazardous industry. Who's going to take care of them? Welfare? If they're permanent?
Well, how many independent businessmen are on welfare because of injuries on the job site? Let's find the problem and let's see some statistics and numbers.
Are there any further questions? Dick, did you have something you want to say?
Well, the only thing that I would bring before the committee is, and I'm sorry I didn't bring it over today, we just went out on a... construction job in Southwest Portland, I believe it was. And we have, on that job, we have a prime contractor who has no employment, but he has legitimate subs, and they're building duplexes and so on. We have the plumber and the heating contractor and so on, but now we get to the framing contractor. I now have a list of the framing contractor has an account, a workman's compensation account. And that subcontractor has four people who are either on an hourly or a monthly wage with him. I also have a list of approximately 10 partnerships that are doing framing and various types of work, and they're being paid on a per square foot. The problem that this bill attempts to get at is that we cannot, when we go out and ask those partners if they are partners and they tell us that they are, then we are pretty well stuck with what they say. However, it's evidence to me that they're performing labor contracts And there, the more we know about some of these partnerships, and I can't speak specifically on this because we haven't got that far in our investigation, is that what we are trying to attempt is to determine and provide the insurance company with is some evidence that looks, that tends to show that these partnerships change in structure, job by job by job. We're also working in the reforestation with the reforestation contractors based upon we've developed quite a program over there, and we see the shifting relationships, partner on this job, perhaps on the next tree planting job, a corporate officer back to an employee. The element that is that the legislation attempted to reach was the fact that the law really doesn't have a remedy on this unless one of those, as it now exists, unless one of those people, so-called partners, if it in fact is a phony partnership, if they are hurt, file a claim, chances are if they go to hearing and they're performing merely a labor contract, we do have a non-compliant employer situation. When you have a prime, a subcontractor with coverage, then it's up to that insurance company to determine who is and who is not an employee. If these partnerships are not paying compensation, but the subcontractor has the veil of coverage under the workman's comp law, and if it is a phony partnership and one of those people gets hurt, he files a claim. If it is really, in fact, determined to be a compensable claim on a subject workman, that contractor has the coverage. He's not non-complying. Then the insurer goes back and attempts to develop the premium that he should have had from the very beginning. That's the real problem.
Mr. Chairman,
sir, of course.
We've had problem explained to us, but you've done it very clearly. We're focusing in on the employer. Maybe we ought to focus in on the partner/employee who floats back and forth between the two roles in order to gain the greatest benefit.
But you also have to hit the corporation.
Well, let's say there is no corporation in this particular area. That he comes, you visit the job site and you say, "Gee, you guys sure look like employees." And they say, "No, sir, we're partners and we're not in a workman's comp and whatever thing." 2 months later, he's hurt, and he files a claim, comes down and says, "I really was an employee."
Right.
And my partner and I, my partner was not covered, and therefore I want workman's comp as a non-covered employee. That seems to be the real problem.
No premium flowing to the carrier there.
Another way to approach it, and of course it gets into the chairman's welfare argument, but another way to approach it is to somehow bind the quote partners unquote to some written statement that they are in fact partners, which would, for as long as they're in that relationship, forever preclude them from making any claim against workman's comp. I mean, you realize you got the welfare argument, but I wonder if we're attacking the problem at the wrong end, maybe.
I realize that, and that is an approach. There's a bill in the House now which would let anybody prior to the engagement of services sign a statement, but the testimony on that is that to gain employment, to get employment, nobody's ever going to get hurt when they start out, so they'll sign it. I don't know whether my personal opinion is that it's bad.
Well, here's my point. Are we shooting for cheaters? You know, you talk about phony.
Yes.
Wait a minute. There are two things. We're shooting for cheaters and trying to turn off the phony partnerships that are trying to evade the law, or are we trying to keep the people off welfare rolls? Those are two separate distinctions.
And I realize
two approaches.
I realize that.
Because I think we can stop the cheaters by front-end loading the thing, and we don't stop the injuries, and we don't cut off the welfare problem, but we sure stop the raid on the fund.
Yes.
By getting the cheaters at the front end. That doesn't solve the question of whether the state has a responsibility for the injured workman who had signed or committed or agreed that he was a partner and therefore uncovered.
Right.
That still exists.
As to the welfare portion, I won't express an opinion.
I understand.
But on the cheaters, there is a problem on the cheater.
I think that case has been made, and the question is whether this approach, mandating workman's comp, is the way to go, or whether it's just saying you make your choice and you're outside, but you can't come back in.
You know, they sign.
That's another alternative.
Right.
How do we distinguish the phonies from those that are not phony? I mean,
that's what all the testimony has been on this bill, Senator. It's very difficult. This provision, which is an attempt to go back to a statute that was in the law prior to the 65 Act, which put a burden on the prime contractor, it's really, I would tell you from a regulator's standpoint, it's a good thing because. Selfishly, I'd tell you from a regulator standpoint, but because it puts every prime contractor in Oregon as a citizen policeman to ensure that coverage is there. I fully admit that my people, when they go out, and I've testified so, if they tell us they're a partnership, if there's a claim filed or a doctor's report that's been signed inadvertently and they withdraw the claim and that, we're stuck with it.
And it's quite a hazardous. How does it compare as far as the industries are concerned? Is it one of the most hazardous? Or
in terms of what, sir?
Frequent claims, accidents.
Well, no. That's not really what the contention has been to bring this problem before you. The contention has been is that there's so much cheating going on that what they're doing is, in effect, there can be a really having the coverage without paying for it until you have the injury.
I see.
And they're not paying their fair share. And by the way, we don't know. I cannot give you numbers on the extent of this.
Probably be one method of reducing workman's comp rates to a certain extent.
That's possible.
Does this have the support of the AGC and the AOI?
I didn't hear his answer.
No. I have an amendment
problem. I hope not. Is there any further discussion on this amendment?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Roberts.
I suggested to staff one change in the in Section 2, which might, and I asked Senator Carson to look at it too, address the problem raised previously about the notwithstanding language, which was adding after notwithstanding ORS 656.027, simply parents 7 and then parents, so that it refers specifically to the language which is in the present bill on line 29, sole proprietors, partners, and officers, and does not say notwithstanding section 1 sub 2. Which is relating to the individual doing work on the private home of the person employing.
Mr. Chairman, I haven't given a lot of thought, but I think that's very innovative, and I think it solves the problem Dick was worried about. In other words, it resurrects Dick's answer to the home thing that Ken was talking about. And I talked to Chuck about it, and he probably liked the opportunity to think about it, because it may have some other ramifications, but I think it's a neat idea.
Wally, could you work with Dick Miller and Rich and see if you can come up with them? You've heard what some of the problems.
Could I try one other thought, and it comes from Jack Kalinowski, which I'd like anybody in the audience to think about. In light of getting together with Richard and Dick, and that's the possibility of going to the Builders Board, and there is a requirement now for when you register with the Builders Board to have workman's comp and beef that section up. Now, the obvious advantage is that that's a lot cleaner than monkeying with this. We don't get into the niceties of employers, employees, and that kind of stuff. You just say if you're going to be in the building business, if you come under that narrow area, you're going to have workman's comp, period.
Okay,
the disadvantage is that it does not include all of the building industry. And I'd like I didn't necessarily any comments now, but some thought about it. I think that's a different way to approach it and might be a little cleaner than going this way. It has some advantages, it has some disadvantages too.
Okay. This is something I think you could discuss with.
Yeah, it may be a wacko idea, but on the other hand, it may be the answer to resolving it too.
Well, there's nothing further.
Well, I'd like to clarify the committee's intent. Now, you've adopted one set of amendments, and then you've adopted the April 11th amendments. Do you still want a new bill drafted with both those amendments, or do you want to look at the second set of amendments and come out with a new form?
Right.
All right. Mr. Chairman, I'm assuming this is the document upon which we're working on this, the 11th, and that would seem to supersede all those other amendments.
Well, it would just be a matter of amending in the amateur athletes in a different section. In other words, the bill would have another section.
Ah, okay.
I mean, if it is your intent to exclude amateur athletes, it can be done under this bill. But it would need another section. But as far as the second set of amendments, Senator Carson's going to work on it, and we'll come up with a new draft of that amendment.
Okay.
Well, are we going to do anything with these farm amendments?
I don't think we need
the farm amendment would only be needed if you pass 430.
Yeah, if we stay with the one we adopted today, we don't need the farm amendments because they're not.
There's nothing further to come forward to the committee. We are.